This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Today's episode is sponsored by Three Takeaways, a top 2% global podcast. More on them later in the show. You've probably seen footage and images of the January 6 riots at the Capitol building captured by today's guest, Ford Fisher. A decade ago, Fisher co-founded News to Share, a radical experiment in decentralized video journalism. He and his colleagues gather long-form footage from all sorts of breaking news events, including protests organized by radicals all across the political spectrum. They upload it to YouTube and elsewhere, and then they let viewers draw their own conclusions. His coverage has been licensed worldwide and appears regularly on networks ranging from CNN to Fox News to NBC. Fisher's channels at YouTube and Facebook regularly get demonetized and in other sorts of trouble because of the controversial nature of his work. I talk with him about why he started News to Share and what he hopes to accomplish by offering something truly unique in an age of 24/7 news coverage. Here is The Reason interview with Ford Fisher. Ford Fisher, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you for having me here.
To get it out of the way, you interned for Reason in 2014.
Yep, that's right.
Right? Okay. What did you have any good takeaways from that?
Yeah, I really enjoyed sort of the corporate culture here at Reason, actually. I interned at Fox News 1 year later. I think that there was more of sort of a freedom culture here, whereas there was a rigid schedule, I think, to how they produced the 6 p.m. news at Fox, which makes sense.
Well, it's got to be done at 6 p.m. Right?
In the end, I escaped all corporate media. Now I just do my own thing. Okay. But I really appreciated both of those experiences.
So talk about News to Share. How did that come into being and what are your goals there?
Right. So I co-founded News to Share in college with another then student named Trey Yinkst, who now actually is working at Fox News. Mm-hmm. And our original goal, which kind of got, you know, evolved and solidified sort of over time. But our thinking was that we were trying to create what we then thought of as a neutral or a sort of an objective news outlet. Our thinking, and now my thinking now that I kind of own the company, is sort of evolved because it began with this idea of, you know, the media has these bias sources, so we're trying to be kind of neutral. But what I've learned is that I don't think that neutrality really sums up the goal. And the reason for that is that neutrality is a claim of equivalence between two positions. So there's like there's a meme that it's like one guy on one guy in the middle. And then there's like a Klan rally and a Black Lives Matter rally. So we want civil rights and we want racism.
Right.
And then some guy in the middle saying compromise.
Right.
Right. Like that would be neutrality. And I don't think that that's what someone ought to aspire to. Objectivity, which a lot of media aspires to, I think is a step in the positive direction, but it's actually still not the word that I prefer to use because I think that there's sort of a coldness to it. First of all, it's some would argue that it's unattainable. You have to have discretion in how you cover something.
And in choosing what you cover and when you start the camera and end it, that all configures into...
Right. It's not like math, right? Like it's still you're making stories about people. And so what I've kind of evolved into kind of a term I've almost contrived is primary source documentary. I think of myself as a primary source documentarian. And what I mean by that is that I try to collect raw footage of situations. Usually it's political activism is the thing that I've ended up focusing on the most over the last decade. And the idea is to capture raw documentary footage of those situations, including live streams. And the purpose of it, putting it out there, is having people be able to see exactly what happened. But the distinction between just objectively covering something like that and thinking of what my work is as primary source documentary is that the purpose of it is for it to take another step that is beyond what I'm controlling, which is licensing to other places.
Right.
So documentary films.
Yeah, you license to documentary filmmakers who use your footage in their projects for cable news, places like Fox, CNN. Can you explain, you had an experience, you covered January 6th, and I want to talk about what that was like from your position, and CNN used some of your January 6th footage. Can you use that example to kind of talk about how, like, you create a primary document, then a news source comes in, and they're going to recontextualize it, or, you know, and it could be decontextualize it, recontextualize it, miscontextualize it. But
sure.
What was going on? What did you shoot at January 6th? And then how did CNN use it? And how do you feel about that?
Right. So I have a variety of stuff. I was at January 6th all day and kind of got a variety of angles. But one of the most kind of notable moments that I captured was the entering of the Oath Keepers, several members of that kind of militia group, into the east door. So an example of how my work is used is that, so CNN licensed that footage and they used it to illustrate an interview with a lawyer representing some of the Oath Keepers. So oftentimes, like, the idea of like, well, I have it in context, it's not necessarily a criticism of the people who are licensing it from me. I don't have any particular grievance with the way that they use that. But I do think that it's important that people who are watching the news and are actually interested in being educated about it should be able to see what things look like in context.
So this is like, I mean, your primary source, it's like a hyperlink in a story where you somebody's quoting a court decision and they have three or four lines. You can click on that and go and see, is that a proper use of that quote?
Right, exactly. And so I've had occasions where I've documented events and I can see that the way that the news covers them, whether they use my footage or not, is sort of inaccurate or misleading. And even when something is accurate, it's still removed and taken into a new format, right? It's a lawyer and a journalist discussing a legal case, and I filmed something pertinent to that case.
Yeah.
For the audience who actually wants to see how it happened, you want to be able to have that availability of video. And news outlets don't, for the most part, actually make that public, right? If CNN had been there filming that themselves, they would only use what they need to make that point. But it's not like they would say, here's our library of raw footage for you to check out if you want to learn more.
Is this, you know, you're part of a lineage now. I would date it back at least to the Rodney King beating. The video of that, which was taken by a regular guy, a citizen who was trying out a video camera, and he happened to look across the way and, you know, he saw the LAPD beating the shit out of a guy who turned out to be Rodney King. And that, you know, became a kind of a flashpoint because it was kind of like a surveillance camera being turned on power on law enforcement in this case. But since then, the ubiquity of cameras and the ability of different people in different contexts filming things, it really kind of changes things. This is also true of George Floyd, right? That absent the video of George Floyd, there probably is not the, you know, that moment in 2020, even with COVID and everything. How powerful is this shift, you know, that you're part of?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Firstly, I do film the police a lot at these political activism type events. I've tended to find that a variable in whether something turns into a Charlottesville-like situation or what I see more often is, you know, opposing sides show up and police actually separate them and then it doesn't enter the news because it didn't turn into a fight.
Yeah.
Right. So I've documented police tactics. And I think that that's really important for people to see when things go bad. Why did they go bad? When things go right? Why did they go right? As it relates to policing beyond activism, I actually gave a speech at a conservative conference in 2019 where I argued to a room full of people who really like cops, basically that you should exercise your First Amendment right to film the police.
Right.
And there was a question I got during the Q&A where there was a person who expressed the concern, well, what happens if you basically film a police officer doing something that looks bad, but it's out of context, right? That you see a cop hitting somebody, but you don't know what happened right before it. And the solution I had to that is like the problem is not that you filmed that moment. The problem is that you missed whatever came first. And so there's all kinds of arguments that people can make about surveillance of the citizenry.
Right.
But I strongly believe in surveilling the state as citizens to the extent possible. And that can mean body cams, right? That kind of thing I do think of as a positive development. But my actual observation has been that police departments often have the discretion to release whatever stuff they kind of want. Sometimes it's forced out by court cases and whatever. But I have a friend who's a journalist who got shot with a rubber bullet in D.C. And when they went to, they said, I want the body cam footage of me getting shot with a rubber bullet. The police said, sure, that'll cost $30,000. not exaggerating. I've seen this email. The way they described it is, well, we would have to go through every single body cam, and then we'd have to redact every single face that isn't yours. Yep. As we look for it, we estimate it'll take this number of man hours. Mm-hmm. It'll cost you $30,000 to get that. And so as much as we might want to rely on the state self-reporting, I do think it's really important that we have citizen journalists out there filming what's happening.
I want to get more into your philosophy a little bit down the road, but first let's look at a video that you posted at your YouTube channel, News, the number two share, just a few days ago from when we're talking, and it's Take Our Border Back Convoy departs for Eagle Pass, Texas from Norfolk, Virginia. It's got 256,000 views in 4 days, which is very healthy. Yeah. What was this and why did you choose? It's 15 minutes long. Why did you choose to cover this and why is it 15 and a half minutes long as opposed to 5 or 50?
So because I live stream events, I tend to have a full coverage of when I'm out at something beginning to end. So if you looked at the live stream from the same event, it's probably an hour plus. It's just however long I was standing there filming in the parking lot. But I do feel unconstrained by YouTube in that I can make videos just as long as I want to. I can include full interviews. I don't have kind of the incentive of, you know, if I worked at a news outlet and covered something like this, they'd say cut it down into a 2.5 minute package and make sure you interview someone from some nonprofit to condemn them as well.
Yeah.
And that takes up some of the space or something like that. So in my case, I go out to a situation like that and I try to document.
Why did you pick that? Like, why is that interesting?
So as we're recording this tomorrow, the border convoy, Take Back Our Border, I guess is what the event is called, is going to arrive at three different locations throughout the southern border. It seems like Eagle Pass, Texas is the one that's probably getting the most excitement because of the current disagreement between the governor of Texas and Joe Biden. So I'll be attending LibertyCon tomorrow, which is why I wasn't personally traveling with that convoy and going to Texas, which I probably would have done otherwise. But I wanted to see the beginning of it for a couple of reasons. Firstly, to literally be able to see the evolution of it. So when they arrive, there's going to be some number of people, which I assume will be more like hundreds, but seeing that first 15 or so. There was also a countering disinformation element to it. And the reason I say that is ahead of this border event, I've seen a lot of inflammatory stuff on formerly Twitter, now X, where I've seen viral posts, tens of thousands of retweets on videos that are completely unrelated to the border event, but captioned as if this is the border event. There was a militias marching in Portland, Oregon, like on foot, and they're claiming these are patriots going to the border. I also saw a clip showing the 2022 trucker convoy being miscaptioned as the convoy to the border right now. And so I do think that raw information is really important to counter disinformation.
Why do you think that video popped? Like, what is it about that topic or the footage that you actually put up?
Yeah, I was surprised by it. That was an incredible view count for what it is. Honestly, I think that it was because people were looking for actual real footage at that moment. The subject has been getting enormous interest on social media, but to that point, it hadn't physically began yet.
Yeah.
Like every time someone was publishing video saying, this is the convoy heading to the border, before that day, essentially it was always a lie. It was always fake. And so I think I was one of the first people to actually publish footage of because it was the first day of it.
And what were they saying?
Footage of it.
The leader of this convoy is in a wheelchair. He's flying down there, but it's What was the content that, or what was interesting about what he was saying?
Yeah, so that was Ivan was the person you're talking about, the guy in the wheelchair. He was actually talking when I interviewed him before they took off about how he hopes to sort of like remove Biden from office in advance of the 2024 election, which I think kind of shows their headspace. He actually, in particular, there's some overlap with the kind of movement to support January 6th defendants. That's been a movement that I've been covering in D.C. essentially since January 6th. And so there is some crossover that I've seen between the kind of post J6 supporters and now people latching on to this new movement, which relates to the border.
Well, let's talk about January 6th, because you have a lot of interesting footage from January 6th. You were in D.C. You were there. What was your takeaway, I guess, from like what you saw and then, you know, what did you see? What did you capture on film? And then how did it get portrayed in the media?
Right. So I actually was at the Trump speech at the Ellipse for the entirety of the Trump speech. And so the perspective that I first captured was and published was literally a 70-minute video. The speech is 70 minutes. The video is 70 minutes. And so you can see exactly how what the crowd would see if you had watched the whole speech ahead of heading to the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
So on the march to the Capitol, I see the front of the people who kind of wanted to lead that. To be clear, people had already breached. I later learned that kind of the initial fighting on the west side of the Capitol had already occurred some number of minutes beforehand. But the people that I'm seeing at the front are Alex Jones, who has said that Trump wanted him at the front of the march, whether it's true or not.
Right.
Ali Alexander, who was the actual founder of Stop the Steal. Owen Schroyer, who was also an InfoWars sort of guy who ended up going to jail for 60 days, as they headed to the Capitol. And upon actually arriving, it had already been sort of overtaken, at least the infrastructure of the inauguration that was about to be happening. So people are kind of fighting their way up the stairs. I'm seeing riot police shooting down pepper balls into the crowd and trying to use tear gas to hold people back. After a somewhat of a stalemate for probably about 20 minutes, there was a moment that I think is actually emblematic of a lot of the issues I've seen and how this issue is portrayed afterwards, which is that there was a moment that police retreated. Like they run up the stairs and people are like throwing things at the cops angrily. And I have later learned that basically this was a moment that the police line had been breached elsewhere. And there was an order given that was basically pull back. We're just defending the building now rather than a perimeter. I have seen other angles of different places in this moment where police basically pull back. And there's been a suggestion online that, you know, police let them in, right? Mm-hmm. Like police waved them on and that kind of thing. And my own experience there was that there's no point at which police are inviting them in, but sometimes they're overtaken and sometimes they pull back for a reason that's inexplicable to you watching it in that moment.
The footage of the Trump speech was pulled from YouTube.
Yeah.
Why was it pulled? It's back up, right?
Yeah. So it's back up, but it requires a certain type of warning. So, so here's what happened. YouTube in general has an exception for their content moderation of ESDA, educational, scientific, documentary, or artistic, right? So if somebody wanted to post, you know, Nazi content or something, generally that wouldn't be allowed. But if it was in a music video, somebody like, you know, showing Hitler to shoot him in the head or something.
How about a documentary? Yeah,
or a documentary about news, whatever.
Yeah, let's make it easier then.
Sure, right. So there's exceptions for certain rules based on that ESDA exception. Mm-hmm. And in general, that's what I rely on to do my work. When I've covered hate groups who wouldn't be allowed to post their themselves saying things like in a webcam, you know, my documentation of them should be sort of exempt under documentary.
Right.
But they changed the rules basically around that January 6th time period where election denial became a forbidden thing to do. Saying that the election was stolen or rigged or whatever sort of became forbidden, but I was relying on this exemption. What I later found out is that they basically removed that exemption unless you include what they later established as a countervailing view standard. So not only can you, it's not only that, oh, I'm a documentary so I can show Trump saying that the election was stolen or something, but now you have to basically say Trump is wrong, right?
How do you feel about
YouTuber.
That?
So I really, really disagreed with their decision, and I said so pretty publicly. So in the case of my 70-minute video of, at the time, the President of the United States giving a speech, to me, I think it's important that people be able to see this exact thing. He was impeached for inciting an insurrection, and I had uncut video of the people who he allegedly incited and how he allegedly incited them.
Yeah,
it's
same
evidence.
Kind of newsworthy. Yeah.
Right. It couldn't possibly be more newsworthy.
Right.
It couldn't possibly be more relevant. And it's unquestionable that it's raw footage, that it's actually truth. The reason it's taken down is Trump made claims of election fraud in your video because I filmed Trump saying that the election is stolen.
So if you had like had a banner running at the bottom saying he is wrong, Trump is wrong, you know, whatever, you know, Big Brother is watching you, that you probably would have been able to keep it up.
So at the time, I didn't know that. So now I've kind of tested the various ways of solving this problem. Mm-hmm. And so today, there are essentially a couple of subjects that can apply to. A, the election was stolen, mm-hmm. and B, things related to COVID.
Right.
Right. So be very careful what you say on YouTube.
Yeah, now, we had a very popular video that got into trouble because it was biohackers who were trying to come up with vaccines very early in the pandemic. And, you know, it was interesting to report on them, but it was got into trouble as COVID misinformation after being up for a couple of years, too, which is fascinating to have stuff that is apparently okay. And then somehow it then becomes material that has to be
sure. And the standard can change. Facebook and YouTube both had rules, for example, in the beginning about you're not allowed to say that COVID was created in a lab, which is now the position on the preponderance of the evidence held by Joe Biden's FBI.
Right.
Right. So so the standard of truth can change. Mm-hmm. In the case of the Trump speech, I ended up reposting it with a warning beforehand where I'm on screen and I was basically like, I resent that I'm supposed to do this, but I'm citing a countervailing view. And so I tell them, you can go to cisa.gov/rumor control. It's a website. Mm-hmm. It's a webpage that still exists where CISA basically says, look how safe the election is. Now, sometimes I do that as a little text at the bottom of the screen, and that seems to solve the problem. Like, and that's how you get them to kind of pass over your video and not make an issue out of it. But they weren't very clear with the standard at the time. And the opaqueness and the sort of ridiculousness is illustrated by the second thing that they took down post January 6th. So on January 20th, Inauguration Day, I went out to cover whatever protests would happen. City is totally locked down. They intentionally made it difficult for people to go in and out. And the only demonstration that I really found was basically a religious hate group. You know, the God hates, you know, expletives and all kind of stuff.
God and, hates bags.
Right. Rhymes with that.
Yeah.
And they weren't the problem. There was a person shirtless across the street from them that yelled, I still believe the election was stolen, but you, sir, are preaching the wrong form of Christianity. My video of of my 8-minute long video of that demonstration was taken down for election disinformation because one random guy not wearing a shirt said that he thinks that the election was stolen as part of a broader point that's unrelated to the election.
Right.
And YouTube was like, nope. There was a claim of election fraud and you didn't countervail it, right? Their expectation would have been that I'd point the camera at myself and be like, this shirtless guy is wrong.
Right.
Which I think is just
And about Christianity as well, right? I don't know. You know, that Jesus is Lord, but he's wrong about the election. Another piece that you did recently that got a lot of views was the Virginia Caucus Militia.
Kakoas,
excuse me. Marches armed to VA state capitol to oppose new gun control. Okay, that is a very well-written headline. It might be a little bit too long, but like, okay, so gun nuts protesting gun control by showing up armed. Is that
Well, I wouldn't call them nuts. I'm, no, again, as a primary source documentarian.
Nuts. Yeah, gun rights supporters, Second Amendment enthusiasts.
There you go.
Yeah, so did that get a lot of play for you elsewhere?
I haven't had anybody license that footage, if that's what you mean. But I think that, again, people are interested in seeing what these sorts of groups are up to. And it's so unpaid attention to, especially during Biden. Like, during the Trump administration, every right-wing weirdo, whatever happened, right? Like, so many cameras, so interested in Proud Boys, militias, and that sort of thing. And during Biden's administration, I have filmed neo-Nazis waving swastikas with guns outside of drag events. Not that I relate that to Biden, right? I'm not blaming Biden for that happening. But the media's instinct to blame Trump for many of the things that happened during the Trump era, I think has caused them to turn a very blind eye to extremism that still exists right now. And so like situations like, you know, militia groups or neo-Nazis, whatever it is, I really haven't seen mainstream media try, like, put that much effort into covering them, although I suspect that that will change as the upcoming election happens.
So is that just a proof of media? Is bias the right word, or it's just that the frame shifts?
I think it's disinterest. I think that their narrative usage of different extremist groups or fighting on the streets and so forth was to sort of make the case that Trump was destabilizing the country or feeding into extremism.
So the same amount of disorder could be happening, but with Biden, we don't want to emphasize that because we like him.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that they can tie it to the left-right paradigm in the same way that they were able to at that time, right? So I have filmed, there's a neo-Nazi group called Blood Tribe that I've now filmed three times, that are more extreme than the rhetoric that you would have heard at Charlottesville. And the media have mostly largely ignored it. And again, I think the way that I would attribute that is that they can't criticize some politician and say that he's responsible for it, which is something that they liked to do with that kind of group.
But as it gets closer to the election, you predict that they will start saying these guys are back and it's because of Trump.
I suspect that they will say that when in fact, many of these groups, and to be clear, what I'm talking about is like literally neo-Nazi groups, consider themselves to be so far beyond Trump. Like when you ask them their opinion of Trump.
He's a cuck, right?
Right. They have insults about, he doesn't stand for anything that we, you know, they're way beyond him.
Let's talk about Charlottesville in 2017. And this was a big kind of breakout point for you, right? Because a bunch of your footage, you basically caught the footage of the Dockers wearing, tiki torch carrying neo-Nazis saying Jews will not replace us.
Yeah.
You know, how did you end up there? And what was it like being at that event versus how you saw it represented in things like the Vice documentary about it, which licensed your footage, right? Or did they use any of your
Vice has licensed my footage of Charlottesville, but you're probably talking about that original doc called Race and Terror did not have my footage in it. So Charlottesville, sort of like January 6th, something about it that I think that a lot of the media missed is that there were events that led up to it. So in the case of Charlottesville, I filmed a rally in Washington, D.C. that was, I want to say, June 25th, so about a month and a half earlier. And the speaker roster was actually almost exactly the same speakers that were slated for Charlottesville. You had Richard Spencer, who at the time was, you know, very popular on the alt-right, Christopher Cantwell, Baked Alaska, a number of these guys. And so I sort of filmed what very likely would have been similar or kind of the same speeches that would have been given at Charlottesville had it not like devolved into insanity. Actually, at the end of that event, a month and a half earlier, Richard Spencer says, everybody, Charlottesville, August 12th, it's going to be a lot of fun. And so I knew about not what would actually like how it would go down, but the fact that such a rally would be occurring was known to me a month and a half earlier because they were saying so. And again, I do think that there's a lot of the time that like the media plays catch up with these events, right? Charlottesville ends up being this huge story, and then the media is scrambling to license footage to tell their story. And of course, you know, made a really big thing out of Trump's remarks about it. But I don't think it would have taken them by surprise as much if they had gone to these earlier rallies, some of which turned violent and some of which did not. For me, Charlottesville did represent a pretty big escalation, though. The chant of Jews will not replace us actually was quite literally an escalation because it came out of a chant of you will not replace us. Like, it was kind of like they were masking the intent or the meaning of what they were doing, you know, in a, behind a very thin wall. But, you know, but they had sort of graduated to saying exactly what they were trying to say by marching through UVA and saying that sort of thing.
And the goal, I mean, or they were defending a statue of Robert E. Lee. Was that the putative?
In theory, the purpose of August 12th, for which they got the permit, was to stand up for the statue of Robert E. Lee, which people had wanted to take down and which has now been taken down many years after that. However, I think by the time that that rally occurred, it was very clear that that wasn't really the purpose or the overarching theme of it. So there were neo-Confederate groups who probably are, you know, oh, no, the statue, right? And that's their main thing.
So then what was it? It was just like a rallying point for a like an alt-right, neo-Nazi-ish.
Well, think about what the title of it was. The event was literally called Unite the Right. And so the purpose of their event in theory was that they wanted to get the absolute most extreme, like actual avowed neo-Nazis together with other kinds of white nationalists and then all the way down to like average Trump supporters. I think, though, that what happened is as it got closer, it became very abundantly clear who is going to this and what you're essentially standing for if you show up at it. And so that was especially clear when on August 11th, the day before the 12th, they, you know, are chanting Jews will not replace us while carrying, you know, torches. So if you were a normal Trump supporter who showed up and you thought you were going to be standing for a statue and just, you know, uniting with the right, you couldn't have possibly showed up on the day of the Unite the Right rally without knowing basically you're standing with Nazis.
Yeah. And then you captured the car attack there, right?
So I was basically right around the corner when that happened. So I heard the car attack and then
And this is a member or somebody affiliated with the protest ran over various people, but killed a person.
Yeah. So James Alex Fields, who I think my understanding is now he's got to die 23 times in federal prison before he can start his Virginia sentence. Once he dies there, then he's got 420 years left.
Okay.
he's got a while. So he had participated with a group called Vanguard America at the time, and he had like their shield and their emblems and stuff that he was wearing throughout the day, kind of as everybody kind of later learned. But as the event was kind of ending in chaos, some people were celebratorily marching through the streets of Charlottesville, and he drove his vehicle basically through that crowd. Probably did not realize that there were two cars parked on the other side of the crowd, which is why it impacted, and he ends up going in reverse after crashing, whereas he probably thought that he could have just driven straight through all of them. And so, I filmed the aftermath of that. The point that I would make actually about kind of the historical relevance of that moment is that Vanguard America, whose shield he was carrying and so forth, basically is what Patriot Front came out of. So today, there's a lot of focus on like, where did Patriot Front come from? Are they like an FBI operation or something like that? I hear a lot of my own audience even is like, these guys must be feds or something. These are essentially white nationalists who all wear the same masks and khakis and everything. Their leader, Thomas Rousseau, I interviewed at Charlottesville. And torch in hand, before lighting it, he told me that he identifies as a fascist. You know, not trying to obfuscate like his, you know, position or whatever, but their rebrand into Patriot Front directly came from the failure of the rally at Charlottesville.
Before we continue with the Reason interview, I want to tell you about another podcast. It's called Three Takeaways. It's a top 2% global podcast, and for good reasons. Three Takeaways brings you conversations with people who are changing the world. In each episode, a newsmaker talks about lessons they've learned, whether in the halls of power, the corner office, or the research lab. Plus, they always share three key insights, three takeaways to help you understand the world in new ways. You'll hear revealing talks with people such as former secretaries of the Treasury and Homeland Security, Nobel Prize winners, former prime ministers, past CEOs of Google and American Express, the former chief of MI6, and many others. These enlightening conversations will enrich your understanding of our world in ways that can benefit you, your life, and your career. I consider Three Takeaways a weekly must, and so do a lot of other people. It's a top 2% global podcast. Insightful conversations for complex times. That's Three Takeaways. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And now, back to this podcast, The Reason Interview.
Can you assess what your coverage and other coverage of that rally, and I guess keep to yours, the primary document coverage, you know, was that effective in revealing what was going on, or does it get decontextualized or recontextualized into something completely separate?
Sure. So, I mean, there are examples of it being recontextualized into a work of art. So I would say, for example, Black Klansman, the Spike Lee movie, like that has my footage toward the end of it. And it's not done in a deceptive way at all. But obviously the construction of, you know, an informant who informed on the KKK before I was born, and then, and then it transitions into footage of Charlottesville of mine. Like, to me, that's fascinating, but is not as like journalistic of a product. There were a lot of individual moments that make more sense because of footage that I had. So to give an example, there was only one shot fired at Charlottesville. There was a guy called Richard Preston who, as he saw a counter-protester basically use a lighter and some kind of aerosol can to make a makeshift flamethrower, he fired a single round into the ground next to that person. And I did not witness the moment that he fired that bullet. That was filmed by my understanding as a member of the ACLU, like a legal observer. Mm-hmm. However, just minutes earlier, I actually did film as he pulled out that same handgun twice, pointing it at the crowd. I think that, for example, contextualizes his own state of mind going mm-hmm. into it, that it's not just like, oh, it was an emergency. I really had to shoot at a guy. I was able to show that he was also pulling it out in effect because people were throwing water bottles at him, you know, at a much sort of greater distance. I think the other thing that you can see in my footage that was important about mm-hmm. understanding Charlottesville was that the police really screwed up. Mm. And so, you know, people can certainly attribute blame to the people actually doing the assaulting, yeah. the fighting and so forth. And so I don't want to minimize that.
Right.
But in general, it's pretty well known. Like, you keep the way that police should carry the objectives of protecting both the right to, mm-hmm. to speech and expression, but also mm-hmm. life, liberty, and property, right, is to keep two opposing sides separate. Mm-hmm. And at Charlottesville, they very, very minimally actually worked to keep sides separate and apart. But when an unlawful assembly was declared, right, and mm-hmm. this is something that I've seen at many other protests, that, like, they decide this has gone on too long, they're breaking yeah. windows or they're fighting each other, whatever the issue is, they declare an unlawful assembly, right? Now it's illegal to be here because right. we've declared that this is a riot, so everyone has to leave. When they did that, the police basically tried to clear out the park by pushing all of the right-wingers out into the direction that the counter-protesters were. Hmm. So the police, in effect, pushed the two sides into each other.
Yeah.
They're fighting, so let's push them into each other to clear right. out the violence. And that greatly exacerbated the violence. I think that it's very easy to focus on the actual characters involved, and especially because the police were at the periphery of it, mm-hmm. There's probably less coverage that kind of shows the dynamic of how that happened. Mm-hmm. But it's something that I'm proud that I was able to demonstrate, right? I think that it contributed to history's understanding of how that failure occurred.
Other things you have covered, a variety of left wing, for lack mm-hmm. of a better word, probably things that are, you know, left or to left of center. I'm looking at a piece that you have up, sex workers protest against raids and FOSTA SESTA in LA. That doesn't draw big numbers, but why did you have somebody cover that?
Yeah, so that was a freelancer, Jake Lee Green, in California. Mm-hmm. I often find that there are smaller demonstrations, but the ones that I'm mm-hmm. less likely to be asked about in an interview or whatever, so I appreciate you bringing it up, that get a lot less attention. And sometimes I'm honestly the only camera, or I have someone there who's the only one filming, that the rest of the media don't touch. So yeah. In the case of that particular demonstration, yeah, that was sex workers, mm-hmm. including both strippers as well as other types of sex workers,
right.
who fantasy facilitators, mm-hmm. who were out there speaking about how the law SESTA FOSTA, which basically removes Section 230 protections from mm-hmm. Online platforms if the outcome is essentially sex trafficking, that it has caused those platforms to be so sort of afraid mm-hmm. Of the possibility of getting in trouble that they've all been sort of banned. And that what they were talking about was that the actual outcome of that is that it's pushed them onto the streets. And so in particular, I think part of mm-hmm. why that demonstration was relevant or will become relevant is that they're having the Olympics in mm-hmm. Los Angeles in 2028. Right. And it is pretty widely understood that some of these sporting events can lead to upticks of people who travel to those events and mm-hmm. then want to solicit the services of sex yep. workers. And if they're not going to be able to do that online because of SESTA FOSTA, then, mm-hmm. you know, basically they held this demonstration out there to say, we're going to be on the street.
Right.
As a result of those various policies. And so, not that I'm taking any position on how they should reform the law or anything right. like that, but I do think that it's important to see kind of the voices mm-hmm. of people who go out in the street and demonstrate about anything.
So I guess let's talk about, I think it's your greatest hit at YouTube from about 5 years ago, San Diego college cop points gun at photographer.
I do want to be clear that that was some, that came from somebody else. Like, okay. That didn't happen to me or one of my freelancers.
Oh, okay. So then why is it at your, but it's a news.
It was an unusual case of like, okay. That was something that I had seen online. I think I sought permission somehow, okay. But like basically I reposted that, but that, yeah. That's not okay. Mine or my own contributor.
Why is that mm-hmm. a great video?
Right. So I do think that although I don't do formal kind of like First Amendment auditing, mm-hmm. I definitely come from kind of like a tradition, I think, of people who see the police as not to be challenged, but to the extent that they try to challenge your act of journalism, mm-hmm. that you should document them attempting to do so. When I saw that that was there and was not like gaining traction at the time, the reason that I posted that particular video was basically to illustrate the kind, mm-hmm. like a very, very extreme example of how the police can create a problem, yeah. for a journalist. I have had other occasions where, for example, while filming the Kavanaugh hearings, mm-hmm. I filmed a cop who is pushing back press to stop us from filming the protesters as they're getting arrested. But the reason that I bring it up is that very rarely this has happened, but I got a YouTube privacy complaint. Hmm. There's actually a method on YouTube where you can report a video and say that the video violates your privacy. Hmm. And you can say the time code, right? Like, this is a moment. And the mm-hmm. reason you would have this tool is that if you were, you know, if someone stood outside your house and filmed through your bathroom yeah. window or something,
yeah.
there has to be a tool to say, like, this video shouldn't be on the internet because it was recorded improperly. Mm-hmm. I got a privacy complaint
wow.
from a cop
yeah.
who really didn't like, apparently, that he was, you know, captured on camera very up close saying, if you do not move back, you will be subject to arrest.
Did YouTube take it down or did they back
it? They didn't take it down. I think that it gave me some ability to like say my side of the, like I entered some kind of a form that basically said like, this is a law enforcement officer.
Right.
Like I clearly had the right to film this person and there wasn't any other action taken on that
wow.
video.
Let's put you in the context of other people who are doing kind of similar things, or I think about this as a kind of, you know, something changed with Rodney King, you know, mm-hmm. and certainly going through, as I was saying, like George Floyd and a lot of different intermediate moments where either police are seen doing bad things or a fuller picture of some kind of event really radically recontextualizes mm-hmm. it and reconceptualizes it. So you're doing it. How do you compare what you're doing to somebody like James O'Keefe, the former mm-hmm. Project Veritas videographer who's now, you know, got kicked out of that and is doing his own stuff?
Right.
And, you know, he has brought down, you know, Acorn and, people at NPR and things like that. How is his project, and I'm not talking about ideologically, but kind of mm-hmm. technologically.
Right.
Is it some – how does it stack up towards yours?
So I think I have a few main ways that I would distinguish it. Mm-hmm. Like you said, I mean, like – so I'll set aside ideologically, yeah. like he's doing that for a specific political purpose and I don't do what I do for a purpose. Mm-hmm. But in terms of technologically, I don't really believe in clandestine recording, mm-hmm. At least in the context of my own work, right? So I film political activism for the most part, and that generally consists of people who are going out in public,
right? They're
to,
seeking
to say something yeah. or do something. And so there are occasionally groups that will be out in public and then to demonstrate about something, and then they don't want to be filmed yeah. doing it. So I could list, for an example, like the Antifa movement in some cases would go out in order to oppose some other group, but didn't want to be seen yeah. doing it the way that they're doing it. Sort of a rare exception,
right?
But in general, people are out on the street demonstrating because they mm-hmm. want it to be heard.
Yeah.
And I think that that's very different from kind of what is typically on the part of the O'Keefe folks,
right.
Sort of manufacturing a situation mm-hmm. and then documenting it. And it's different in a couple ways. Firstly, when I'm filming, mm-hmm. you know that I'm filming, right?
Yeah.
I'm holding a large yeah. camera and I'm usually live streaming. And so mm-hmm. someone could literally see that I'm covering it
yeah.
in real time. In the case of someone who's secretly filming and usually has manufactured that situation by pretending that they're dating the person and then interviewing them by asking them questions while they've drank, like these sorts of situations. They're documenting a situation that would not be happening if they had not started it. Whereas in general, I'm documenting situations that would be happening whether I'm there or not. This is also a distinction about like the idea of platforming, right? So a criticism that has sometimes existed of my work is the idea that when you film something that you're escalating their position. That if you go film the Trump supporters saying something ugly or whatever, or the left, right? I mean, I've heard it, this criticism in both directions, that you're escalating them by giving them a platform. And I think that that can exist in media. I don't see myself as doing that because for the most part, I'm documenting what they're already saying.
Right.
I think that like this is platforming, right? Like I wouldn't be sitting here talking across this table if it wasn't being recorded for a podcast, for an interview. In the case of like circling back to like the O'Keefe thing, right? Like they're creating a situation that would not otherwise be occurring. They're not just documenting a conversation.
And then they're editing it. They're presenting a situation as self-explanatory. Like you don't need to go outside of that. They give you a single context with a single interpretation, which is this person is corrupt. This person is wrong. This person is whatever.
Yeah. And so in their case, like I've heard them being accused of deceptively editing, taking things out of order, whatever. And also removing the context of like they'll have someone go on three dates with someone to make them vulnerable, right, to then spilling the beans about something that they wouldn't otherwise say. Like that kind of situation, all of that context is devoid from the video that ultimately comes out.
Right.
Whereas in my case, you know, my highlight reels can be sort of backed up by the live stream. I can't even think of an example of someone accusing me of deceptively editing. But even if someone leveled that accusation, they could go and look at the live stream and they'd be able to sort of make their case and by pointing out what they think I've removed wrongly.
To be clear, you know, O'Keefe or Project Veritas are kind of in a tradition of 60 minutes. This is, you know, 60 minutes would talk to people for a long time and then edit things, right?
Right.
You know, and often were accused of deceptive editing or motivated reasoning and things like that. What about somebody like Andy Ngo, who used to, or, you know, he gained notoriety by, you know, you mentioned Antifa, kind of filming Antifa, oftentimes from like a flip phone and things like that, or a phone. How does his work stack up to yours?
So I think that, again, a couple of like primary distinctions. One is that I do think that most of his work is shaded by an ideology, right? That if you go to the post-millennial and see what he's reporting on, he's mostly reporting on either crime of some kind of a specific nature, like, or, you know, misdeeds committed by people kind of coded as leftist in one way or another.
Yeah.
And so there's definitely an ideological bent to what he chooses to focus on. And I would like to think in general, I tried not to allow my own kind of like political beliefs.
Why is that a value to you, this neutrality? And again, it's not objectivity. Right. It's not really neutrality, but why would your politics not inform what you cover?
So I don't want people to look at footage and think, what does the cameraman think of what they are filming?
Yeah.
Right. So like I have political views, right? Like I go to all kinds of political demonstrations. And so I hear people arguing about politics all the time. And of course I have things that I've, you know, thought in my head. I have my own opinions of those situations. Truth be told, often I think everybody's wrong.
Right. Yeah.
But the way that I would interview a pro-gun or an anti-gun activist, I would like to think in general, I try not to ask questions that are shaded by how I feel about the particular situation. And I want people to not view me in either direction as like hostile. If someone like, you mentioned Andy Ngo, but there's also, you know, lots of left of center reporters, just someone with a CNN badge, by the right wingers are kind of afraid to talk to that person or believe that that person is inherently going to be kind of against them. And so I think being from a non-politically factionalized media allows a certain level of comfort when you go and talk to somebody that they don't feel like you're coming in against them, whether they know my reputation for raw journalism or whether they just see the word news to share.
Yeah.
And then they ask, are you left or right? And I'm just like, none. I'm just raw.
There's a left of center collective called Unicorn Riot. Who are they and how does that kind of intersect with what you're
doing? Yeah, so I've worked kind of alongside them on several occasions. So Unicorn Riot has done a number of live streams and raw video kind of collection pertaining to some of the same subjects that I've been at, where they've filmed both things on the left that they actually will say they support and things on the right that they will say that they oppose. And so it's interesting because their approach is still on the ground journalism, which I do find a lot more valuable kind of than people who just sit online and write about other people's videos. But the distinction in style is that they are they're outwardly stating a political position. Right. If they're filming a right-wing rally, they will tell their audience this person is wrong or dangerous or whatever because of this or that. Or while filming a left-wing event, they will actually kind of like, write positively of the people who they're covering. I actually do appreciate, though, when news wears their bias on their shoulder. Like, if you're going to do biased coverage of some kind, I'd prefer that you say it as opposed to sort of proclaiming a kind of false neutrality and then not actually being that, which I do think a lot of the cable news networks kind of do.
Right. And even Fox News makes a feint towards that. I don't know if they use fair and balanced anymore, but like they were, they might have been winking when they said that. But the idea is like we are a real news network. We're objective. And then MSNBC, CNN, and Fox are quite different. Do you have like kind of heroes of documentary film? Like who are the people that you kind of look up to and guide the way you do things?
So I hold Errol Morris in really high regard, in particular for his documentary Thin Blue Line. That film, I think, is what I sort of aspire to. And so to be clear, I mostly have filmed primary source documentary in order to be licensed to other I've contributed to other films much more than me making complete films. But what I really, really liked about that project is that he basically proves that a person who had been on death row and was at the time that he was interviewing him serving a life sentence for the murder of a police officer, he essentially proves that that person was innocent and by the end of it kind of gets a confession from the person who actually did it. And what's so fascinating to me about that project is that he doesn't use narration, right? Like, and so like his voice or his filming and editing style is really the ability to capture the words of others and not try to like throw himself into the middle of it. But by the end of it, basically, he very convincingly makes the case without words that the subject is innocent.
You know, we've talked to Errol Morris several times, and he's fascinating because he believes in truth. You know, he will say, if a dead body is there, that's a fact, and somebody killed it, like it died somehow, and our idea is to figure out how it got that way. So he, you know, in that is seeking truth in a way. But The Thin Blue Line, when it came out, was very controversial among documentary filmmakers because, among other things, he used reenactments, which were generally seen as not cricket for that. And then you realize, and I can remember, you know, I agree, it's a brilliant movie. He's a fascinating filmmaker. At the end, and I'm sorry to ruin it for people who didn't see it in like in 1988 or 87, whenever it came out. But when you realize one of the main sources like picks his hands up and you realize he's in jail, et cetera, like, and he's the guy who obviously who murdered the person in question, you realize that you have been being played the whole time. Like, this is an expertly edited narrative film in the form of a documentary. So I've always found him interesting because he's a truth seeker, but you know from the beginning that you are going to be taken on a ride that he is controlling.
Right. Someday I have a project in the works, but I can't, I'm not even going to tease it in any kind of public way, but I am attempting to make a documentary that, will use a style somewhat like that, that again is investigating a subject that I'd be spilling the beans if I told
some of your footage though was, used in his American Dharma.
Correct. Yeah. So he did use, footage and from Charlottesville.
Yeah. And that's the, Steve Bannon and it's fascinating to think about somebody like him who has impeccable credentials as a documentarian and as a filmmaker, and he's made narrative films and kind of blended forms, Wormwood, a fantastic series about MK Ultra that was on Netflix. But he could not get a distribution deal for a long time for American Dharma because he was seen as platforming Steve Bannon. Is that like, what do you think of that kind of response?
So, I mean, we kind of talked about this concept of platforming before, and literally it is platforming. I mean, they're going to sit down across a table and have a conversation like this in order to make that film. But there can be value to doing that. I don't think he was doing it. He certainly didn't make an ad for Steve Bannon. Yeah. I remember him saying basically something like, I'm doing this because I'm afraid of you guys.
Right.
Right. Like, and that was his perspective of the truth of that was to like dig into what Bannon.
I don't
think
anybody watching that movie was going to be like, yeah, you know what, Bannon. I'm on Bannon's side now. And
right,
although maybe, but if they were already, I guess a larger question in the work that you're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, people, they need the primary source documentation because that's the stuff that you're putting out there, but they don't want anybody else to be able to, take it out of context, right? They want to supply the context. And do you worry about that? I mean, because we live in an age and your entire enterprise is a tribute to this, like where it's easier than ever to produce and consume documentary footage or all sorts of cultural and political expression. And not surprisingly, people are going to extreme lengths to say, I need to control what you consume.
Right.
Is this just an arms race that's going to continue? Or do you think we can get to a point where as a society, you know, you don't have to worry about YouTube saying, you know what, you showed this horrible crime that indicts a person for being a horrible person who happens to be president of the United States. So we have to take it down, like where they're just going to be like, oh, yeah, we get it. Like all of this stuff should be out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think culturally people do want to have the ability to be informed. Mm. I think that there's a skepticism of, I mean, you heard it in Trump would use it. And I think that it applies essentially across the board, but Trump would use it and attribute it to the left. But this is the claim of fake news,
right?
So people in general have a skepticism of mainstream media, I think in part because they now have these alternatives, right? If somebody can go to my channel and see a video that kind of shows that the way that something has been presented is false,
right,
they are going to disbelieve that other outlet and want to rely on mine. And to the extent that someone like me is censored for it, right?
Yeah.
That is going to make them more skeptical of these big corporations. And so I do think that that's a constant fight kind of back and forth that's taking place. There are alternatives, right? So there has been, you know, Rumble. Mm-hmm. I do have an account on Odyssey, which automatically cross-posts my content from YouTube to back it up.
Yeah.
I do have an account on Minds that also, I think, cross-posts my Twitter stuff. The problem with these alternatives, I think, well, I'll start with the good thing about those alternatives, I think, is, well, like, number one, that they exist.
Yeah.
But secondly, that they might put some level of pressure on the bigger tech to say we should censor less because if we censor more, then people will go to these other platforms. The big problem with them, though, is that our society is so gobbled up with these gigantic media corporations, right? Facebook/Meta, Twitter/X, YouTube/Google. That it's really hard to just step aside from those. Like, I have a lot of friends who have kind of just, in the same sort of media space that I'm in, who have just sort of said, I give up on YouTube. We just do Rumble now.
Yeah.
And maybe they give up on Twitter and maybe they're back because of Elon or something. But the problem for me is that I do want my audience to be a cross-section of normal society. Yeah. I like that in my replies, I see people debating the issues because they don't all come out on the same side of the thing that they've watched. I film an anti-Trump protest. There are Trump supporters and there are anti-Trump people in the comments fighting about that. And I would prefer that those conversations be happening than go to some, you know, I could post it on Parler and I know it won't be censored. Right. Well, I guess I don't know if Parler still exists, but
yeah, that's a good question. I was like, what are you talking about?
But I think Parler, on Truth Social. I could post all my content on Truth Social and I probably wouldn't be worried about being censored, but it would just be showing it to Trump supporters, right? Like these alternatives tend to create echo chambers of the sorts of people who were sort of separated from the other social media.
Going in the other direction, the proliferation of Twitter-like sites and things like that, Blue Sky or whatever.
Right. I've found that to be a really fascinating phenomena because like what the right went through and then the creation of Gab, like these sorts of spaces that are really extreme in the opposite direction. Right now there's Blue Sky, Threads, whatever, that are basically just, oh, Twitter is too right wing, so we're going off to somewhere else. And I think they're encountering the same problem because I've had people tell me like, use my Blue Sky invite code. I've had so many people tell me like, you should be on our thing. And like, maybe I would get the numbers of views, but I don't think that I would get like a cross-section audience. I don't think I'd just be reaching normal society. Yeah. I'd be specifically reaching people who would leave Twitter because they don't like Elon's politics. Yeah.
Do you have a politics? I mean, you interned at Reason. You said you interned at Fox News. So that's, you know.
To be clear,
those
with
are
Brett
two data Bear. Points.
So,
okay.
So it wasn't not the Fox News opinion portion.
Oh, okay.
But I mean, I interned at Reason and you can probably derive a certain amount of inference about my political opinions from that. I tend to have a skeptical towards state solution, probably opinion of most stuff. But the thing that The only subjects on which I publicly advocate tend to be those that are interested in free speech. And I think I'd be comfortable publicly calling myself like civil libertarian as it relates to those issues. So, for example, like I am interested in creating primary source work of my own. But the equivalent of that as it relates to government is government transparency. I very strongly believe in, you know, the absolute transparency of whatever is possible. Like I've seen people on the left say we should release all the January 6th footage so that we can catch all of them and get them in trouble. I've seen people on the right say we should release all the January 6th footage because we want to prove that they were feds or something, you know, whatever.
Right.
My position is we should release all of it because people are entitled to see it.
Yeah.
Right. Like it's just pure, like I actually don't care which side that would benefit.
Yeah.
I just basically believe in government transparency. And the same could be said about kind of the free speech of journalists themselves, right? An anti-censorship perspective.
You have covered a lot of elements of violence in American society over the, you know, the past decade since you've been doing this roughly. Do you feel as we go into the 2024 election really kicks into high gear, are you worried that there will be an intensification of violence or do you think that is mostly those fears are based on the way that it gets covered by mainstream sources?
Yeah. So leading up to January 6th, I saw that January 6th was thought of as like a last stop kind of for them. Like this is kind of our last chance. And I think as we head toward the 2024 election, there are a few different possible last stops that can occur. And essentially, I don't see a path out of 2024 in America that doesn't include serious sort of like street fighting, insurgent terrorism, violence of some kind from some perspective. There are different inflection points that could occur. So you could have, if Trump is somehow denied the presidential nomination, you could have violence at the RNC. If he gets it, you could also have people who don't like Trump getting into engagements at the RNC. You could have Trump incarcerated sometime between now and then, which I think could possibly spawn violence. But then when you actually get to Election Day, I've been thinking about this for a long time. And I've actually pretty much since Trump, it became clear that Trump would run again. I've been warning my wife, like, this is going to be a crazy 2024 will be insane. And you have to be prepared for me to travel and film all kinds of violence and everything like that. When Election Day comes about, I don't envision practically any scenario in which Donald Trump loses and concedes. I don't think that it's like basically possible. I think that if Trump loses, he will say that he won. He will be convinced of fraud and so forth. And January 6th can never happen again in the way that it did, right? Like the Capitol will be probably you know supplied with 10,000 National Guard guardsmen, no matter what. But there are a lot of state capitals, there are a lot of election boards, there are a lot of judges who could be seen as the issue in a scenario like that. And on the other hand, if Trump wins, there are a lot of people in this country who would view him as essentially like we just elected in a dictatorial power or something. And that also spawns a certain type of potential insurgent violence and so forth. As I look at the country now, it's like, you have like roughly two halves and it's like roughly half of the country believes that the election was stolen, that democracy is fundamentally already broken and we have an illegitimate president in the White House. The other half of the country believes that the last guy threatened democracy right. in a serious way, that January 6th was an insurrection or a coup. And so with most of the country holding one of those opinions, I really think that democracy is in a very, very dangerous place as we get to the 2024 election.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Thank you, Ford Fisher. News to share.
Real happy note to end on with that.